Hello, my friends. Welcome back. I've got the great pleasure today of having the opportunity to chat with one of the most intelligent researchers that I have ever had the pleasure of interacting with. He's been on my channel several times, and hopefully we'll be back several more times, Professor Ben Bickman. And I'm going to bring him on, and we're going to pick his brain about all things metabolism, insulin, glucose, glucagon, etc. Dr. Bickman, welcome.
Hey, Ken, good to see you, brother. Always nice to chat with you.
Absolutely, absolutely. So we're live in our private group. We've got 5,100 members. And so I'm going to kind of let them throw their questions at you as they come. That's kind of one of the perks of being in the private membership. But then we'll post this later on YouTube, so it should get plenty of views because your information is not only sound, but also immediately applicable. And most people that follow my channel, they love that. They want to hear some advice, put it into action, and see results pretty damn quickly. And I don't blame them for having that common sense mindset. And I've always found your advice to be very useful in that regard. Tell us first and foremost where you're based at, what your research kind of entails, what you're working on right now. And so we can, people who've never heard of you can go, oh yeah, he probably knows what he's talking about.
Yeah, sure. Yeah. So my academic background is in my PhD degree was bioenergetics, which is just a fancy way of studying metabolism, nutrient metabolism. And I followed that up just like a physician has a fellowship. So too do scientists. I did a fellowship with Duke Medical School studying metabolic disorders. And then I started my own lab here, and I'm at BYU, where we just, the snow just keeps on coming up in the mountains of Utah, which has made for a killer ski season. And my wife makes sure we go every week. She's right there now skiing with her girlfriends. And my lab, the focus is primarily metabolism, but that's a big word. A lot of it has been focused on the pathogenicity of insulin, where we know that insulin, of course, is a critical hormone. It's a hormone of life. It's a hormone of building. The problem is when you have too much of it and the body's constantly trying to build. It's constantly anabolic, if you will, and you're not giving the body enough time to be catabolic. That presents a significant metabolic burden. And then beyond that, but kind of related, we study a lot of on ketones, and just by way of listing some interesting examples, we're doing a project right now with Rick Johnson, who's become quite well known because of his uric acid research. He's been on, he wrote a very, very good book about Nature Wants Us to Be Fat. And he's just a wonderful gentleman of a scientist, which more and more, Ken, you know, the older I get and the more the world is changing, the more I look at scientists and even, you know, physicians, these people with these glamorous terminal degrees, and I can't tolerate them. I can't handle the ego and the smugness and the certainty. It is so antithetical to science to speak in such certainties and to invoke the science as if it is some religious creed. And I'm a very religious guy, you know, for the record. I have no problem with declarations of faith. But I also know what science isn't. And science is not a declaration of faith. It is this rigorous skepticism of trying to prove yourself wrong. And nowadays, we just have, anyway, scientists that just, and physicians, prominent people who, it's all gone to their head. And pride is the death of science because you become too married to an idea. You must be constantly humble enough to admit you are wrong. And that's becoming absent in the world. Nevertheless, Rick Johnson is a uric acid scientist. So one of the interesting things, we know that uric acid causes inflammation. That's one of the consequences of it. And that is likely the mechanism whereby insulin resistance, whereby uric acid promotes insulin resistance via inflammation. What's interesting is to see that when people adopt a ketogenic diet, two paradoxical things occur. It's not uncommon. One, invariably common, which is that inflammation markers will get better. You know, C-reactive protein, for example, will improve. But at the same time, it's not uncommon for uric acid levels to actually go up a little bit. Well, that should be impossible. If uric acid's going up, inflammation should be going up, and other metabolic problems should be getting worse. And our suspicion and our evidence so far hints at this is that ketones are providing a sufficient anti-inflammatory effect to block the consequences of the uric acid. Now, for the record, it is not a universal phenomenon that uric acid levels go up. Many people who adopt a ketogenic diet, they go down. You would see this much more than me as a clinician, of course. But there is evidence. There are clinical studies to show that uric acid levels go up a bit. Whether it's going up to a point that would be problematic is certainly debatable. But even still, it should be something that we look at and appreciate objectively.
Yep.
But the ketones appear to be mitigating or entirely blocking the potential negative effects of the uric acid. So that's just one example. And numerous other projects looking at the effects of inhaled air pollution on fat cell metabolism, and several more.
And you brought up the uric acid, and I find this area of study fascinating. And I've actually, I read very far and wide in the biological sciences. And in many of my readings, I've come across the concept that uric acid is itself an antioxidant.
Yep. That's
true. And that elevating uric acid levels, first of all, as a clinician, I can tell everybody watching this, that absolutely does not mean you have gout. There are many ill-informed, partially educated healthcare providers out there that if they see an elevated uric acid level, by definition, you have gout and they put you on allopurinol or Euloric or one of the other medications. That's absolutely inappropriate and just plain wrong. And so what I've found from reading widely in animal biology, not just human physiology, is that every mammal that cannot make its own vitamin C tends to have higher uric acid levels. And we see this across multiple species of animals, from humans to the primates that don't make their own vitamin C. Not, some do, some don't, to even to guinea pigs that don't make their own vitamin C. They'll have a naturally higher uric acid level.
Interesting.
It's fascinating. And so I have stopped seeing uric acid as a holy villain. It's not just a villain. In fact, the more I research this, the more I think that uric acid is not a villain at all. Uric acid is probably serving, as we know in biology, not just one useful purpose, but multiple useful purposes, some of which we probably haven't even teased out the mechanism yet. What do you think about that concept?
Oh, I love it. I absolutely love it. So we do know, you're absolutely right. Uric acid is an antioxidant, and it helps maintain a proper redox balance. We need some oxidative stress. We can't get rid of all of it. We need it. And it is known, as you stated, that uric acid helps balance that redox and combat some oxidative stress. I love the point, which is that when it comes to biology, we cannot talk about villains. Like, as much as I talk about insulin as a villain, now it's also the hero, depending on what story we're telling.
That's right.
And yes, uric acid can be a villain, but it also can be a hero. And it plays a role. And of course, as happens so often, you know, the poison's in the dose.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So let's take a question, if you don't mind, Doctor.
I'd love it. Nothing warms a professor's heart more than taking
so a question. So if you're watching this on YouTube, we did this live inside of our private community. So our members got complete and total access to Professor Ben Bickman, one of the preeminent brains in this universe, trying to tease out What is proper human physiology? What is a proper human diet? Let me see. So I've got some questions. As you know, you were speaking earlier about the hubris of just stating a position, especially as a scientist or a doctor in the mainstream media, that this is just settled. This is known. This is not up for debate whatsoever. And one of the most common ones that you'll hear if you're listening to certain tenors of mainstream media is that red meat consumption absolutely increases your risk of developing type 2 diabetes or insulin resistance. And eating saturated animal fat, eating fatty animal meat, is going to increase your risk of type 2 diabetes or hyperinsulinemia or insulin resistance. Break this down for us. Talk to us in hopefully layman's terms about the physiology, about why this can't be. It just isn't. It's just not true at all. And then I wouldn't mind at all if you really jumped on with both feet the hubris of saying such things to people who are not scientists. They're just like, okay, this guy's a researcher at Harvard or Tufts, you know, and he said this, therefore, who am I, a truck driver, a hairdresser, a waitress, who am I to say that's bullshit? I can't, I don't have the bona fides to say that. So how's just the average person watching or reading, and when they hear something like this, how do you even begin to go, well, is that true or not?
Yeah, in fact, let me just start with that as in my answer here, then I'll address the specific points. I do have very, very strong feelings about the way the world is going and how science, I don't want to talk in silly terms here, so I do want to be careful here. Science has kind of become a new religion, where it's become a religion of the modern world, and scientists are the priests and priestesses of this new doctrine that's being preached, this gospel, which is that we are the authority and we'll tell you what is best and you just need to do it. It is deeply concerning for me. And at a deeper level, and this might be a bit of a polarizing statement, as a very religious man, I can't help but kind of think maybe this is a product of sort of the death of religion in a classic sense. That kind of worries me a little bit, that people are we want to look for truth. And I think where we tend to turn away from it, and societally we are, the statistics are quite clear, where we turn away from it when it comes to conventional organized religion and the kind of Judeo-Christian view, I think it makes people look for truth somewhere else. And then science becomes a very appealing one. It certainly is what happened in cultures where religion was banned. And as someone who lived in Russia, as I did in the mid 90s, shortly after the fall of the Berlin Wall and the end of communism, it was amazing for me to see the explosion in interest in religion, whereas previously it had been illegal. So anyway, I know there's a lot of personal thought there, and I don't mean to inject that too much, but for the average individual, if there's one good thing that's happened over the past few years, while there are very shrill voices who try to speak with a false authority because they have a terminal degree, a PhD or an MD, as much as I reject that and it worries me, I'm also thrilled to see that there's a growing number of people who say, forget you, that does not pass the test, the stink test. I can smell the BS all over what you're saying. But at the same time, as a scientist and one who is with many, many others, physicians and scientists, biomedical scientists, who are trying to find answers to relevant questions and share those answers, I don't want people to ignore science completely. So the average individual, and you noted a truck driver, those are guys for whom I have a massive amount of respect. My dad basically raised 13 kids by owning a trucking company in Southern Alberta. So these are guys that I just think are salt of the earth, who are the life.
And they are so common sense. I mean, it is 1 + 1 = 2. It has to be that way when you're out on the road.
Yep.
Or somebody will die, and you won't find a deeper level of common sense than you'll find in a truck driver. And so how's a guy like your dad, when he's on the road and he hears, on CNN, this PhD, MD, JD, says red meat is going to cause type 2 diabetes. Right. You need to avoid it.
Right. Yeah. So then let's shift to that then. Perfect timing. What I would hope that the person who just wants to drill it down to the simplest idea, at the very simplest level, the whole idea breaks down. Because if you look at the consumption of red meat within the United States over the past 60 years, it has gone, well, it went up a little bit in the 70s, and then it has had a steady drop year over year from the time of around 1970 till now. We eat less red meat now than it appears we probably have ever eaten, at least in recorded history of the United States of consumption patterns. And I suspect even further back, as a percent of calories, we eat less red meat. It has been going down over the past 50 years. And look at what has happened to the trends of virtually every chronic disease, diabetes included. It doesn't even pass the simplest level of correlational, just eyeball test. You look at one curve of saturated fat or red meat, I'll say, because I'll get to saturated fat in a second. I mean, by every metric of USDA and the United States monitoring consumption patterns, red meat is going down and diabetes keeps going up. It just doesn't work. Even at the most superficial level, the whole idea breaks down. And if you'll allow me, Ken, again, I don't mean to sound like I'm someone's preacher. But it's amazing for me to even see how, can I mention a scripture in the New Testament just
absolutely.
For fun?
Yeah, absolutely.
Just for fun. Anyone who believes in the Bible, just go to 1 Timothy chapter 4 and read what the Apostle Paul told Timothy, this young disciple, when he was prophesying of the latter days, our days, if you will, looking into the future, if you believe Paul had any kind of prophetic gift. And one of the things he says would be a sign of the times would be that people would command others to abstain from eating meat. And these would be people who had been deceived, in his words, by the spirits of devils. And I don't want to sound silly. I'm very practical, but also very religious. But it's amazing to me that even in the New Testament, 2,000 years ago, there were people who could see the trend of people who I would say maybe kind of are losing their minds. And they would try to command you to not eat meat. And Ken, you look every celebrity, every sports star, every government entity and corporate entity, what is the one thing they all agree on is that meat is bad and we shouldn't eat it. Well, I look at that and say, get thee hence. I'm not doing that. For me and mine.
I'm perfectly comfortable discussing religion and sociology and psychology. I also read deeply in those fields as well. My undergraduate minor was in abnormal psychology. I think if you study the human creature enough, it is self-evident that humans look for meaning. Yeah. And we are tribal animals by literal definition. There is no way to get around that. We look for a belief to latch on to and to use to create part of our identity. Our identity is in part comes from our clan, our tribe. In part, it comes from what we believe and what we eschew. No, that is false. I don't believe that. And even people who believe in nothing, if you're a complete agnostic or atheist, you still, if you've studied the human creature enough, you know that we are highly susceptible to latching on to a belief. For many of us, it's a very popular belief, or it's a belief that is propounded by somebody who we look up to, a celebrity, an athlete, or somebody, and we'll just irrationally will adopt that belief. And if that's part of who I am as a human being. Humans are very susceptible to that, and scientists, you would hope, would be aware of that weakness in human beings. And so, even if you don't believe in a God, you still have beliefs in something. Yep. But it seems like scientists are actually, in many cases, using.
Oh yeah.
Some would call that a weakness in human nature, or some would call it a strength. Let's just call it an attribute of human nature that we love to believe in stuff. We love stories. We love mythology.
Yep.
Whether it's ancient or modern, it doesn't matter. But we are highly susceptible to latch on to something like that with no evidence whatsoever. And it seems like many of the plant-based PhDs, MDs, and world authorities on health and nutrition are absolutely latching on to that attribute of human nature that people will believe irrational things if it's said by the right person.
Yeah, yeah. So indeed, with regards to kind of plant-based view, the most common refrain is that saturated fat causes insulin resistance and thus causes type 2 diabetes. To just sort of finish that final question, because I have very, very strong thoughts on that. And if I may say so, I can speak with some authority because I've published multiple reports on that. Much of my fellowship experience and the manuscripts that came from it was based on exploring the differential effects of fatty acids and causing insulin resistance. So this is what they get right. And then I'll say what they get wrong, because what they get wrong outweighs what they get right. What is correct is that when you take a cell culture, so I'm growing muscle cells or fat cells in a little petri dish.
Yes.
And if you incubate those cells with palmitate, the most common saturated fat in the bloodstream, they will become insulin resistant.
Absolutely.
And that's what they get. That's what they get right. That is true. But where they get it all wrong is once you go one step deeper up or one step further up, when you say, okay, what about the whole body? Is treating cells analogous to eating saturated fat that may come from red meat? It is not. Jeff Volek has shown very, very conclusively that if carbohydrate consumption is going down, even if you double or triple the amount of saturated fat a person is eating, the amount of saturated fat in the person's blood is significantly reduced. Yep. And then as you titrate the carbs up, even if saturated fat is down, now all of a sudden saturated fat in the bloodstream starts to go up. So the great myth is them assuming that these studies, some of which are my own publications, I published those reports, and I had to go through my own evolution and awareness to realize, wait a minute, Ben, you're enough of a physiologist. Yeah, I'm a cell biologist, but I'm enough of a whole body guy to realize that treating cells with palmitic acid is not the same as eating a steak. Absolutely. And indeed, the evidence doesn't back it up. These studies have been very well done. If you have someone who's eating multiples more saturated fat in the context of a low-carb diet, their insulin resistance gets significantly better. So too do markers of inflammation and, of course, numerous other clinical outcomes. So at the base level, with randomized clinical trials, they are wrong. They are, if I can be silly, they're preaching this false gospel, this message, the mission that they're on, even if it's with the best of intentions.
Yeah.
And I don't know that it always is, to be perfectly frank.
Agreed.
I can speak as a person who has published and conducted these experiments. What you see in a cell culture does not translate to the whole body and the consumption of fats.
Absolutely. I got a good question from Mario here, and I don't know if you've seen this as feedback as much as I have, but it looks like about somewhere between 1% and 5% of people who are true carnivores, fat and protein, fatty meat, eggs with the yolk, that's what they live on. About 1% to 5% of these guys, over the years, their A1C will start to creep up. And I never see it go back to type 2 diabetic levels, 6.5 mm-hmm. or above. But I have seen it creep up to 5.7, 5.9, in very rare cases, 6.0. What do you think is going on here? Now, I have a couple of theories on this, but I would love for you to jump in on this. What's mm-hmm. going on with these guys? And these are people that I pretty much know personally, and I believe them that they're not sneaking some Oreos when nobody's looking.
Yeah. In fact, Ken, this is a question that I take so seriously that we have just completed a study that we collaborated with Levels Health, the CGM app manufacturers. They sponsored this study, and I'll get to that one in just a second. That'll be the second part of my answer to emphasize some of what we're seeing. It's all pre-published, so I'll just can kind of mention it as preliminary. But on the first point, what I wonder at is how A1C ignores the fact that it is a formula that has two variables. One variable is the glucose and the glycation. The other variable is the red blood cell itself. Because that's where we are measuring this A1C. We're measuring it on red blood cells. And so what I think is very important is that as someone starts eating a diet that is heavy in red meat, they are so adequately nourished with heme iron that what I believe is they create a scenario where their red blood cells simply live a lot longer than normal. And the longer a red blood cell lives, it's just more likely that it's going to get glycated. Now, glycation is not an inherently pathological process. It's very important for people to realize that. It's just a marker of what your glucose levels are. It's not that it's destroying and obliterating your red blood cells. But again, just to state it, just so that I'm clear, when you go on a really meat-rich diet, your red blood cells become longer lived. And so again, it's just more likely that it will get glycated, as opposed to, say, being plant-based, where you're so nutrient deficient that your red blood cells have a much shorter half-life or a much shorter lifespan. And so in both instances, you end up getting this either a false positive in the case of the carnivore, who seems to have an A1C that's problematic, but in reality, their glucose is fine. It's just that their red blood cells are so darn long-lived. In contrast, you could have a plant-based person whose glucose levels are not fine. They're higher because all they're eating is starches and sugars possibly, but because their red blood cells are so fragile and they die so quickly, they don't have time to get glycated. And so you get this false negative where it looks like maybe false positive in this case, it's a good sign. You'd think that it's low, but in reality, it's this false sense of security because their glucose levels are problematic. And then the second part of my answer that we've been studying is that we do know that when people with type 2 diabetes eat protein, they have a much higher than normal glucagon response. And so kind of putting A1C to the side for a second and just looking at glucose, similarly, analogously, they're in parallel. There are people who adopt a carnivore diet and their glucose levels don't really drop. or they find that it's kind of, maybe they were good before and they've kind of gone up a little bit. There are some people who have an exaggerated glucagon response when it comes to protein. This is now me mentioning some of the preliminary data where we see that people who tend to be low carb but have higher than expected glucose levels, maybe they're hovering around the 90s or even low hundreds. These are people who, when we gave them a pure bolus of whey protein, their glucagon went much higher than the group who has a low level, kind of more the expected range of glycemia. So two parts to this answer, one part being that they just might have really robust red blood cells that are kind of indestructible. And at the same time, there may be some people who have a higher than expected glucose level just because they're having a bit of an exaggerated response to the protein with regards to glucagon, the hormone, which glucagon always wants to be pushing glucose up a little bit.
Love it. Love it. I got a good question here from Neil. How is it that not all calories are created equally? How does the type of cell, fat, protein, carb, affect insulin as it relates to fat storage?
Yeah. Oh, I love it. Love it, Neil. So this is a wonderful question because it's starting to touch on a debate that is really raging within the kind of low-carb keto space where people who were once low-carb advocates are rejecting the idea and going back to the old-fashioned calories in, calories out model, although they call it something different and put a bit of a different spin on it. And I don't mean to talk derogatory. Truly, I don't. I want to be kind and diplomatic because these are people I know, even if I disagree with the trend. But that statement or this sort of reversal or evolution, if they would call it, I would call it a reversal, they'd call it an evolution, and that's fine to disagree, is based on the idea that all calories coming from particularly carbs or fat are equal. I reject that premise completely because of my own evidence and evidence of many, many others, because it is ignoring the fact that the body, the human body, is not a perfect closed thermodynamic machine where every calorie in can be accounted for with every calorie out. Moreover, as Mike Eads has recently posited and his talk was just put on YouTube, maybe we should reject the whole calorie idea completely because we aren't made up of calories. Our fat cells aren't made up of energy. We aren't made up of energy. Calorie is a unit of energy. Perhaps we should reject the whole idea and just look at mass. Yes. What is the mass of food coming out? What is the mass of nutrients that are coming out, coming in, mass of food coming in, mass of food coming out, or nutrients coming out, or molecules coming out in the form of CO2, which is the breakdown product. And you can measure CO2. Anyway, to look at glucose or carbs and look at fat and just say, it doesn't matter, they're both the same.
Yeah.
To me, it is illogical because we do know that one will cause an insulin release, one won't. And I know some people say fat releases insulin. It doesn't. If you're a type 1 diabetic where you have a naturally hyperglucagonemic state, you might need a bolus of insulin if you're a type 1 diabetic because that is a broken metabolic state. And I don't mean for that to sound derogatory. That's a disease. And it's not the average individual. If you are not a type 1 diabetic, you can eat fat and you will have no insulin release. We've just done those same experiments in my lab, confirming results over decades. So what's the relevance of this? When insulin goes up, metabolic rate slows. David Ludwig has published this. Even Kevin Hall has found this, that higher insulin spiking diets will slow metabolic rate. We found that insulin will slow the metabolic rate of fat cells. So we know that insulin has a suppressive effect on whole body metabolism. And we've found that it has an effect directly on fat cells. Fat cells do have a metabolic rate. Insulin slows it down even more. In contrast, when insulin is low, not only is metabolic rate accelerated, but you also are now wasting energy in the form of ketones. Every ketone that you're breathing out or you're urinating out has a caloric value roughly similar to glucose. These are calories, if we want to invoke energy again, or potential calories, or we would say mass, to kind of align with Mike Eads' message. This is mass that you're literally just breathing out. Every ketone that comes out is a molecule that would have had to be stored or burned. You know, if we follow the kind of caloric, paradigm rigidly. And so the idea, to bring it back full circle and to kind of answer the question again, hopefully clearly, I think it is laughable and unfortunate that we've gone back to saying that we have regressed to say that carbs from calories from carbs, calories from carbs is the same as calories from fat. It's true if you're burning it over a Bunsen burner in a lab, but it totally ignores the fact that the human body, when in the human, in any organism, hormones tell the body what to do with the energy that it has. So maybe just to put a fine point on it, I can grow fat cells in my lab in a little Petri dish, and they are swimming in a sea of calories. There's glucose in there. There's fats in there. And the fat cells will stay small cells. They don't know what to do with the energy until we put insulin in the culture medium. Once we put insulin in that little bath, now the cells know what to do and they get fat. So in the within the human body, when it comes to telling the body when to make fat cells and when to store fat, when to store energy, insulin reigns supreme. Thus, as much as I'm not ignoring calories, in fact, I dare say I have a unique appreciation given my background studying metabolism and energy. Bioenergetics is the study of energy in organisms. I have a unique appreciation for the thermodynamics of the model of the human body and its cells. But at the same time, I'm mature and educated enough to appreciate that that endocrinology matters too. Hormones tell the cells of the body what to do with the energy that they have.
I love it. And one thing I find fascinating about some of the gurus and influencers out there, I know that probably after 10 seconds of hearing them speak, one word comes to your mind, which is sophomoric. They know just enough to be able to parrot some things, but they really don't understand the physiology at any depth whatsoever. And that's one of the things that really fascinates me is when people say, well, you know, carbohydrates are energy, fat is energy. But everybody knows that we use protein to build things with, right? But so many gurus out there don't realize that we use fat. Fat's not energy.
Absolutely.
Fat is a molecule. Fat is atoms. Fat is tissue. Mm-hmm. And we use fat to build hundreds of things in the human body. So to say that, a gram of fat is 9 calories of energy, that's like saying that a gram of protein is 4 calories of energy. No, absolutely not. We use that protein to build hundreds of things. We also use the fat to build hundreds of things as well. Give us your take on that. Oh, I think Dr. Bickman is locked up. We'll give him a second to see if this corrects itself. Are you there, Doc? I think we've lost that connection. I'm going to send him an invite. You wait right where you're at, viewers. I'm going to send him a quick invite so that he can rejoin and get this conversation going. This stuff is so important. Okay, Doc, if you can still hear me, I sent you another invite in case you need that. Yeah, okay, he did. He's already done it. That stream is locked up. There we go. Okay, we're back.
Sorry, it went black. Yeah, so let me just finish that thought with an exclamation mark. I love, Kent, thank you so much for noting that as much as we just talk about fat as an energy source and we give protein this pass by saying it's just a building block, that's not wrong about protein. I don't think we should count protein as a calorie source. Maybe we shouldn't call any of them calorie sources.
I agree.
But fat is a molecule of life. For example, imagine trying. Everyone talks about protein. We need protein to build muscles. Yeah, building the protein is what's constituting the inside of the muscle. More protein is developing more cross bridges within the myosin structure of the muscle, and that starts increasing the volume of the muscle. But as the inside is getting bigger, what's happening to the outside? The membrane of the cell is getting bigger and bigger and bigger. And that's not protein, that's fat. The membrane of the cell is made up of fat. So good luck trying to expand a muscle. You can put all the protein in there you want, but if you don't have enough fat to make the membrane get bigger and bigger and bigger, it's not going to get big. In fact, it'll die. This is why that studies that document muscle protein synthesis and the rate at which a muscle will get big. If you give people pure protein, yeah, it'll get a little bigger. If you give them protein and fat, it'll get bigger even still. Because you can't make cells get bigger unless you have enough fat to build the membrane, because most of the cell membrane is made of fat.
I love it. And the body uses fat for so many other things, including the myelin sheath of axons on the nerve cells.
Hormone synthesis.
Hormones. Yeah, just hundreds of things. So to pretend that a gram of fat is just 9 calories of energy it's kind of foolishness.
It is.
And then I just posted a video on my YouTube channel about calories and the foolishness of it, because fat on your body, people will say, they'll literally say, oh, that's stored energy. No, that is tissue. That is molecules and atoms. They have a weight. And so let's talk about that calorie model a little more, because I'm ready for it to hit an iceberg and start to sink. And I know it's going to take years for it to sink. It's the ultimate Titanic, but it needs to sink because so many people have been diluted for so long. I mean, people have been on Weight Watchers since 1963.
Yep.
Counting calories and waiting for that to fix their obesity, and it just doesn't work. So the fat on your butt, the fat. First of all, human beings are by design fatty primates. We're fatty. So for a man having a body fat percentage of 10 to 20%, that is normal. That is healthy. That's actually optimal. For women, 15 to 30% is optimal health. Nobody should. It's not optimal health to look like the guy on the cover of Muscle and Fitness.
That's or people who are posting pictures of themselves topless on social media. Yeah, yeah. I mean, that's not most people. And you and I are aligned in saying most people, unfortunately, most people shouldn't care to be like that. So yeah, unfortunately, Ken, you're a little more optimistic than me. I don't think the ship is sinking. The whole kind of calories in, calories out ship. Right when I thought it was sinking, we see people that we thought were on our ship who are jumping ship and getting back into that sinking ship, buoying it back up. So I don't think it'll ever die. There's so much invested in that paradigm that it's going to be a battle for those of us who just try to say, nah, there's more to it than that. Hormones matter here. And if hormones matter, then the composition of the food matters and macros matter at least as much as the amount you're bringing in. So yeah, unfortunately, I don't think it's going anywhere. One of the problems with the calorie centric paradigm when it comes to weight loss is that it ignores hunger. You know, hunger has different phases to it. There's this kind of gastric phase where is there something in my stomach? Okay, I'm full. I'm not hungry. Then the stomach empties itself out. I feel a little hungry. That's a very acute phase of hunger that passes. Give it a couple hours and you'll be fine. That hunger will go away. Then you get into this longer kind of phase of, I guess, for lack of a better word, an energetic hunger, which can go very, 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 very long. Not that I'm telling people to do weeks long fast, but they could. It's this phase where you start to get into this state where you use your own energy as fuel, your own mass as fuel, as energy. You know, it's like this analogy of the fuel tanker that's driving down, you know, all these truck drivers that are hauling fuel to the gas stations to fill them up. Within that massive truck that's hauling fuel, that truck will have to stop a couple times a day to fill up its tanks because it's using a tank that is right under the cab. Ironically, so much of the work of that engine is hauling all of this fuel that's strapped to the back. That is kind of analogous to the human body, where we have a small reservoir of glucose within the body, about, you know, 2,000 calories. And yet we're hauling around hundreds of thousands of potential calories in the form of this mass that we store as fat. Fat, that is fat cells' most famous effect. And indeed, we need it so much. Ken, as you note, we are the only mammal that is land-based born obese. Every other mammal on land is scrawny compared to humans. Yep. We are uniquely fat mammals. And it's thought to be because our brains are such energy hogs. They demand so much energy that all of this fat can turn to ketones, if we allow it to, in the absence or when insulin is low, that it becomes the preferred fuel for the brain. That's certainly the case for newborn babies. And again, that's why as babies, we are the only ones born obese, because we have this big hungry brain and we now have all this fat mass that can turn to ketones, which in babies it does very, very readily. You know, a newborn baby is almost constantly in a state of ketosis, and that's wonderful fuel for the brain. So back to this kind of metaphor of the fuel truck, that's what we have. So I, you know, here in the beautiful mountains of Utah, people go hiking all the time, and I will see people going on a hike and they have all these energy bars and energy drinks, and yet they're really, really overweight. And I look to myself and just think, ah, it's like the human body has bandoliers of energy bars. They're on the body, ready to go. We just can't open those wrappers or take off the top of the bottle until we let insulin come down. But we need to learn to use our own fat as a fuel. That is one of the reasons it's there. But can you mention in women, and just as a brief aside, part of what interested me in metabolism and got me on my journey was the realization that fat tissue was an endocrine organ. I had no idea. I learned that on my own as a master's student. I had never learned about it. The dozens of hormones that come from fat cells. It is one of the most active endocrine organs in the body, rivaling the thyroid and the adrenal glands and just how busy it is. And these are good hormones. These are bad hormones, but all part of the symphony of instruments that, that constitute the complexity of the human body and endocrinology. But some of these hormones are absolutely essential to fundamental processes within the species, like reproduction. You know, we always talk about leptin as it's a satiety hormone. Well, sure, but we could also say that it's a hormone of reproduction, because it is. If you don't have enough fat cells, particularly in women who bear the metabolic burden of reproduction, to produce enough leptin, the brain will say, ah, there's not enough energy on this body. I'm not going to let me reproduce. We need fat. It is essential. And lest we always curse it and try to rid it from our bodies, it's there for a reason. And the very few people who have a genetic inability to store fat as fat, a condition called lipodystrophy, they have severe cardiometabolic consequences because of it. So before we curse it, maybe take a moment to be grateful for it.
Absolutely. I totally agree. John says, any physiological evidence about using artificial sweeteners, drinking soft drinks like Diet Coke, Diet Pepsi, and how that affects the metabolism, and then also caffeine stimulants.
Yeah. So when it comes to sweeteners, I typically have three categories. One is just actual nature's sweetener in the form of, you know, sugar. Yeah, that's, of course, problematic. It can have a very significant insulin spike. Then when you get to another class of sweeteners of the sugar alcohols, that's a really broad class. Some have no effect on insulin secretion, like erythritol. Some have a very modest effect, like xylitol. Some have a higher effect, like mannitol and maltitol, and others that I don't even remember because there's so many of them. So the sugar alcohols are kind of a spectrum. And then lastly, you have the artificial sweeteners like aspartame, or the natural sweeteners like allulose, stevia, or monk fruit extract. Those have no effect whatsoever. And so I look at those pretty favorably. The only consideration that I have with sweeteners, even the ones that have no insulin effect, is that as long as you know that it's not kind of lighting up your brain, and you eat the diet, you drink the diet soda, or you know, a shake or something with a sweetener in it, and if you can just stop with that, then I have no problem with it. If, however, and if you're being honest with yourself, you find that when you take that, it makes you start craving something else that's sweet, or it, you know, because you are kind of tricking the body when you do that. Because in nature, if you taste something sweet, you're going to get glucose in the bloodstream, no exception. You know, that fructose will get converted to the glucose, or it's coming with glucose anyway. And so you just have to make sure that what you are drinking that diet soda or whatever it may be, and you stop with that, then I have no problem with it. And then when it comes to caffeine, I also, in theory, have no problem with caffeine, but I do think it can go too far. And unfortunately, I can't list like a certain milligram amount per day, but there are people who can find that they resolve their hyperglycemia completely. Like, they may go carnivore, but they still drink so much coffee or so much caffeinated soda. Caffeine does stimulate glycogenolysis from the liver. Caffeine wants glucose to go up. That's one of its primary effects. But if you're able to kind of keep it at a low enough dose and stop it early enough in the day that it's not affecting your sleep, then I have no problem with it.
Yep, I agree. Sherry, if ketones don't go down after consuming stevia or other plant sweeteners, that would indicate that it didn't raise my insulin. You stated in your book, but others say this is wrong. What do you
think? They're wrong, Sherry. I'm right. If it doesn't lower your insulin, that is, you can be exceptionally confident that it's not spiking if it doesn't lower your ketones, you can be very confident that it's not spiking your insulin. Now, having said that, and having just mentioned caffeine itself has a ketogenic effect, albeit mild. So it is theoretically possible that you could have some caffeine coming in with an artificial sweetener, and then the artificial sweetener would elicit some insulin bump, but the caffeine elicits its own ketogenic bump, and maybe you would maintain some degree of ketosis and not see it impacted. That is purely within the realm of theory, though. What I can tell you is that these sweeteners that I just mentioned do not increase insulin.
Gotcha. Vanessa, fatty liver. She has fatty liver. My doc wants me to go on statins. First of all, what the hell do statins have to do with fatty liver? They're in no way going to reverse your fatty liver. They're not going to help your fatty liver at all. Vanessa has fatty liver, Dr. Bickman. What would you recommend that she do?
Yeah, well, I'll answer my part, but as the clinician, Ken, I'd love to see and genuinely hear what you think about it.
Yep.
So just to cite human evidence, we know that most of the fat that comes into, so the liver gets fat through two processes. One, it makes its own fat when insulin is elevated. But that's the second part. So I'm starting with the smaller portion of it. Most of the fat that comes into the liver is actually fat that's dripping out of fat cells when the fat cells become hypertrophic and insulin resistant. That is not the same as lipolysis when insulin is low. Because if you're breaking down fat when insulin is low, the liver can't store it. Because remember, cells will only store fat when insulin is elevated. And so when you flip this around and now it's a hypertrophic insulin-resistant fat cell, you not only have elevated insulin, but the fat cells become resistant to insulin's efforts to try to inhibit fat breakdown. And so the fat cell basically says, insulin, I'm too big. I can't grow anymore. I can't listen to you. So I'm going to start leaking fats anyway. Now you have this paradoxical and pathogenic metabolic state where you have both high insulin and high free fatty acids. The liver bears the burden now. And so most of the fat that's constituting the fatty liver is coming from the fat cells that have become insulin resistant. So the solution is resolve the insulin resistance. The best way to do that is to adopt dietary changes that allow your insulin to come down, because hyperinsulinemia is the primary driver of insulin resistance. So it's no surprise that there are multiple, some pilot studies, some deeper studies that show you can have complete resolution of fatty liver disease by just adopting a low-carb diet. Paradoxically, that might be higher in fat, because eating fat doesn't cause fatty liver disease. Insulin resistance does. And the relevance of the statins is utterly beyond me.
Yeah, it's completely irrelevant. The statin's not going to help your fatty liver in any way that I can think of, Vanessa. Yeah, I've got, I think, 5 or 6 videos on this YouTube channel about reversing fatty liver. If you'll adopt the lowest carbohydrate diet that you can tolerate, if you want to reverse your fatty liver very, very quickly, you need to adopt a carnivore diet. And within 90 to 180 days of a carnivore diet, your fatty liver will be completely gone. It will be back to normal if your fatty liver is indeed non-alcoholic fatty liver. If it wasn't caused by alcohol, if you're not continuing to drink, if you're not continuing to take supplements or over-the-counter or prescription medications that are causing your fatty liver, you will reverse and completely cure your fatty liver within 90 to 180 days. Keep in mind, Vanessa, that not only the liver can be bombarded with inappropriate pathological fat, also your pancreas. You can have fatty pancreas, which is a huge deal. You can have fatty heart. You can have fatty kidney. All of these things have been documented in the physiology.
What about fatty tongue, Ken? I heard that from you.
Absolutely.
I learned that from you.
I've got a video, yeah. And so people with obstructive sleep apnea almost invariably have something called fatty tongue. And if you're like, well, I thought the tongue was muscle. Yes. And so if you can talk your sleep specialist into ordering an MRI of the tongue and the throat, you can see this readily, that your tongue is marbled, just like a delicious ribeye steak is marbled with fat. If you have been eating too many carbohydrates, specifically drinking too much fructose, you're going to have fatty heart, even fatty lung has been documented, fatty kidney, fatty throat, and fatty tongue. And that's why the vast majority of people, when you go on a very low carbohydrate diet, your body's not an idiot. Your body is very ancient and very wise. It's going to metabolize the most dangerous fats first. that's going to be the fat, probably the very first fat to go is fat that's been stored in the pancreas, then fatty liver, and then fatty kidney, then fatty heart, and then fatty tongue. And that's why so many people with obstructive sleep apnea, after 3 to 12 months on a ketogenic, a ketivore, or a carnivore diet, they're like, dude, I don't even need my CPAP machine anymore. I sold it on eBay. I don't have sleep apnea. And it's not, and so it is partially because you just lost weight overall, but specifically it's because you reversed fatty tongue, which was the, you only have so much space in your oral cavity, in your oropharynx. And if you've got enough marbling in your tongue, if you have enough fatty tongue, then when you sleep and all those muscles relax, that big fatty tongue is going to fall back into your airway. You're going to have sleep apnea. And so not every single person losing weight cures their obstructive sleep apnea. There are very slender people who have obstructive sleep apnea. This is absolutely true. But even in slender people with OSA, they notice a great improvement in their symptoms when they reverse the fatty tongue that comes from being chronically hyperinsulinemic, which is a signal telling your body to store that fat in inappropriate areas.
Yep. Yeah. Ken, let me share one last thought about fatty liver disease. I would just want to know the person, you want to know whether that's been confirmed through ultrasound or similar of the liver, because if the physician has just relied on your liver enzymes, so-called the transaminase enzymes, ALT and AST, you need to make sure that when you got that blood test, you didn't work out hard in within about a 24-hour period, because it's a little-known secret, too little known, that those enzymes are also very heavily prominent within the muscle cell. And so if you've had a hard workout and done a little damage to your muscles, which does happen with workouts, especially if you've been working out the legs, then you will absolutely have higher levels of those enzymes in the blood. They didn't come from the liver. Your liver's perfectly healthy. It might have just come from you had a hard workout. So if you've been diagnosed with fatty liver disease, you want to make sure that you didn't get that blood test following, you know, about 24 hours of a hard workout, whether it was endurance or resistance exercise, because it's probably simply a sign of working muscles rather than damaged liver.
That is a brilliant point. And this is something that many people in my tribe, and we're live right now in our private tribe, that's where these questions are coming from. Our tribe members are able to ask Dr. Bickman their personal questions directly. But so many people, and here's the problem. When I say people, I often mean healthcare providers, Dr. Bickman. They think that the AST and the ALT are like dummy lights on the dash of your car.
Yep.
If the ALT is high, that means you have fatty liver or some liver pathology. That's it. There is no other explanation. And very, very often, and I find it to be just a principle of human physiology, there is nothing in the human body that just does one thing. I think that the list of things in your body that just does one thing and nothing else, you could probably count on one hand, if not two. And we're talking about hundreds of thousands of different compounds in the human body. And so that's a brilliant point, that just because your ALT is high, that does not mean you have fatty liver. You need to have your liver scanned. That's how you're going to document the fatty liver. And actually, still the gold standard to this day for fatty liver diagnosis is a liver biopsy. But now, most docs don't want to do that. Most patients don't want to have that done. And I don't blame you. But just checking an AST and ALT is not definitive for fatty liver. There are multiple other things that ALT and AST are markers for. And they're not just produced by the liver. They're produced in multiple different places. The average healthcare provider has either never learned that or they've forgotten that. And therefore, you're left with someone that has almost a crippled sense of human physiology. And very often it's to your detriment if you just blindly believe what they said. It's a brilliant point. Yep. Thank you for making that. Mm-hmm. Let me see if I can find another question or two here, Doc. This is brilliant. I had a question. Oh, no. One of the other tribe members asked, do you believe that longer fasts, so not just a daily fast, but maybe a 2-day, 3-day, 5-day fast, is that going to help reverse insulin resistance quicker? Is that safe to do for most people? What's your opinion on that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. So fasting is a double-edged sword where it is such a powerful tool that it can be a tool for you know, better or for worse. So when it comes to multi-day fast, you know, that's a delicate topic, and people need to be very careful that this isn't a kind of glamorized version of an eating disorder, where they purge in the form of a fast, and then they binge when they are eating. So I get a little worried when I see people jumping into fasts a little too quickly. It worries me that it's just a form of an eating disorder. But there's no question it can be a phenomenally effective intervention to improve insulin resistance, particularly if you are really overweight. The problem with multi-day fasts is if you're getting to a point of actual starvation, which is when you're getting low enough on fat that you now start cutting muscle, that's the difference between a fast and starvation. The fat tissue defends the muscle. And the moment, which is why you can have the guy who fasted for 384 days in Scotland, I believe, documented as a case study published decades ago. He didn't lose muscle at all. And yet he fasted for over a year. It's because he had enough fat to burn, and fat spares the muscle. And so all this hyped up stuff about you fast and you're going to lose muscle, it is so overhyped. That just doesn't happen. Much of what you say is muscle mass that's being lost is actually just water, but it just gets lumped into lean mass.
Yeah.
You're not really losing muscle. Fat defends
and
muscle.
Let me add to what you're saying. Let me jump in. The way that lean body mass is calculated by many machines, it also includes just free water in that calculation. And so when you fast, your insulin level is definitely going to come down, which is going to lead to some degree of diuresis, right? You're going to pee off some extra fluid that you were holding because of the hyperinsulinemia. To some of the machines, not all of them, but to some of the machines, any loss of water from your body looks like a loss of lean muscle tissue.
Yep, that's exactly right. Yep, so I think the fear about losing muscle mass is overblown, way overhyped by disingenuous people or outright deceivers or ignorant people. That's probably more often the case. But even still, when it comes to multi-day fasts, I always, of course, suggest a degree of caution. In my mind, the most how you end a fast is more important than how long you fast. That while we really stew over, I got 24 hours, now I'm 48 hours, now I'm getting to 72. That's all fine and dandy, but how are you going to end it? Because that to me reflects whether this has simply become a binge purge cycle, which I think is very, people need to be very honest with themselves. And if that's what's happening, then stop it. Then just stop fasting and just get back onto a cycle of eating, but eating smart. But how you end the fast matters more than how long you go.
Yep, I totally agree. Okay, Sharon says, what's the difference between your body thinking it's being starved by a low calorie, like a calorie restriction diet and storing fat, and fasting with no calories that makes it burn fat? So how is calorie restriction, how is that different than fasting for longer periods of time? How can your body kind of sort out the difference there?
Yeah, so there are, that's a very, we're kind of starting to split hairs, although I very much appreciate the effort. But there are studies to show that chronic calorie restriction does not yield, although there are studies to show no effect, but there are some that, and enough for me to cite and believe that they have value, to show that all calories equal, intermittent fasting elicits greater improvements in weight loss and insulin resistance than just chronic calorie restriction. I would also say that could be because when you're intermittent fasting, you do have periods of profoundly low insulin. And when insulin is low, you train your body to tap into the fuel resources that you're carrying around. It's the fuel tanker, the big truck rumbling down the highway, where when one tank starts to get low, the little one, you can replumb the fuel line to start tapping into the energy at the back. That is a benefit I would submit of intermittent fasting that allows it to have a metabolic advantage over just chronic calorie restriction, where you're maybe kind of spiking your insulin, especially if it is low fat, which it always would be if it's low calorie. That starts to work against you, where you're stopping the fat burning. Because when glucose is spiked, when insulin is spiked, the metabolic engine shifts from fat burning, which turns off, to sugar burning, blood sugar. And the effect and the benefit of a fast is to be in a state of fat burning.
Now, good question. I talk about the cephalic phase insulin response a lot, and I think now Dr. Bickman will know exactly what I'm what I'm drawing on the screen. This is a normal distribution curve, right? And it's my opinion that in some people, the cephalic phase insulin response to even non-caloric sweeteners in some people is higher than in others. Now, a lot of people say there's no such thing as the cephalic phase insulin response. I think the literature makes it pretty clear that there in is. All mammals, there is a cephalic phase mm-hmm. insulin response, not only just to the taste of sweet things, but if you see or smell food, it's going to raise your insulin to some degree. So let's break that down from a physiological yep. standpoint. Is the cephalic phase insulin response to a non-nutritive sweetener, is that something we should worry about? Is that something some people should worry about? Is that something no one should worry about?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. In fact, I even had a section on this in my book, just really trying to elaborate this, that there's no question there's such a thing as the cephalic phase. When I talked about the kind of breakdown of those calories or the sweeteners that I mentioned earlier, a lot of it is if there is a cephalic phase. And that's sort of reflective of the comment I made earlier where we are kind of tricking the body. And the worry is where I said, if you eat this sweetener, non-caloric or low-calorie sweetener, if you can stop with that, then it's fine. If you eat that and it starts to drive you to want to eat something else, then you are probably a person who does elicit a cephalic phase for whatever reason. But if you've had an insulin response, that little, even if it's a small one, the insulin is going to signal to the body to start pulling in energy. And so the total availability of energy in the blood will go down a little bit in the form of lower glucose, lower free fatty acids, lower ketones. And the brain, who has no ability to store its own energy, will sense this and panic a little bit and say, hey, we're getting low energy. We need to bring something in. So the kind of poor man's method of knowing whether you are a person who does have a cephalic phase, which is a real thing, but isn't common with those sweeteners, but not impossible. If you drink a Diet Coke or whatever, or for me, it'd be a Diet Dr. Pepper, and you feel like you're really hungry after, then you probably had some sort of cephalic phase release, as modest as it may be. But insulin's trying to tell the body, hey, we had energy come in. Oh, wait, we didn't. And the brain is left to try to reconcile that a little bit. Now, yeah. Usually, if you did feel like you were a little hungry, I'd like to say you can kind of tough that out, give the body a little time and the nutrients in the blood will go back to where it was. So it should be quite acute, but the cephalic phase is real. The degree to which these sweeteners will affect it, in general, it would be none. No effect, but it does. It is a thing.
Now, you've already spoke to this a little bit, Doc, but let me ask you about this. In certain corners of the keto and the carnivore universe, there are people who are saying, if you do a water fast, you're going to lose muscle mass. That's going to happen. And so they're promoting this thing called a protein-sparing modified fast, where you eat small amounts of just almost mm-hmm. pure protein during the time when you would be doing the water fast, if that's something you would do. I think you alluded to this earlier, that on water fasting, if you are eating to satiety during your eating time, mm-hmm. You're going to lose water, but you're not going to lose any meaningful amount of muscle mass. Is protein sparing modified fast, is that a thing people that should adopt, or what do you think about that?
Yeah. So I have a, when I first saw this, I believe Maria Emmerich was the first to talk about this. She was the first I saw. And I really have a lot of respect for her. I think she's very charming and wonderful. So I don't want to, maybe I shouldn't have even mentioned her, lest it seem like I'm attacking her. I'm not. When it comes to an average fast, if it's within a kind of 24-hour period, I do not believe there's any reason to worry about eating protein. My personal thought. And I confess, if there's a lot of research on this, I'm not aware of it. And I'm aware of a lot. But I don't think this has been really teased out to give people the confidence across all the spectrum for or against to talk about this with too much certainty. If this turns into a multi-day fast and you are a relatively lean person and or you have very high intensity workouts, I could see some relevance to this. But even still, the body isn't meant to consume protein alone. There's a little part of me that says, if you're going to take a little protein, you should take a little fat, because in nature, there's no exception. And you know, I'm a scientist, so I want to try to speak carefully. So I'll say it maybe this way. I'm unaware of any exception where fat exists alone in nature. It does not happen. It's impossible. I believe that is reflected in how humans should eat it. And it's no surprise to me, with that view in mind, that bile acids are very important to proper and full protein digestion. If you eat pure protein, you get no release of bile from the gallbladder or the liver, and you don't digest the protein as well. We know that this happens. This has been known for decades. When a little bit of fat comes and the bile acids come out, you digest the protein better. So I guess I kind of, I resist the idea of protein sparing modified fasts on two levels. I think it does overlook the fact that if you have plenty of fat to burn, fat, and you can burn it, fat protects muscle. It defends muscle. And so you won't lose muscle. I think the fear, as we've discussed, the fear of losing muscle is overhyped a little in the average person. But moreover, I think it ignores nature a little bit by taking protein in alone. Protein doesn't exist alone. In our hubris, we've pulled the two apart, in our hubris and in our fear of fat. I don't think that's appropriate. I think they're supposed to come together.
Yeah, I totally agree. And I very often will talk about an ancient human diet. And very often people who don't agree with me will call that an appeal to nature. And they would say what you just said is an appeal to nature. It's a logical fallacy. Just because protein doesn't occur in isolation in nature, that has nothing to do with human physiology. And I would strongly disagree. I don't think that's an appeal to nature. I think looking back at the human diet for the last, as far as we can go, million years, if we can, I think that's very important.
Well, and the fact that bile is essential for complete protein digestion. We not only see it in nature, but we see it correlated with human physiology. That to me is proof positive.
Yeah, I totally agree. And thank you, Mitzi, one of our mentors, for bringing up Dr. Bickman's book, Why We Get Sick. If you enjoyed this, then you're going to love that book. It's available as a paperback, a hardcover, and there's an Audible for you folks out there with ADHD like me who can't just sit still and read a book. Dr. Bickman, I'm so appreciative for you doing this with us today. Thank you so much. I'd love to have you back anytime. My tribe loves you. And next time I do this with Dr. Bickman, if you'd like to ask him your questions personally, consider becoming a member of our tribe. There's a link down in the show notes. For $5 a month, you get access to brains like that brain right there.
Oh, there's a lot of it. There's a lot of it.
That sounds like a good deal to me. Thank you, doctor, for your time. I appreciate it so much. See you next time.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Oh.